agenda for today, Wednesday, the 9th of March 2016. There will be apologies if we have received any, the adoption of the agenda, the deliberations on the Unemployment Insurance Amendment Bill, and then we go to a clause-by-clause consideration of the bill, and then if everything goes well, we have the draft to vote on the bill. And thereafter, when we're done with the bill, we will have a presentation by the Financial and Fiscal Commission, and then to deliberations on that presentation and consideration of draft committee documents. Thank you, Chair. I haven't received any apologies yet. Thank you.
There's the agenda members in. Any comment on it? Honorable Lolio.
Thanks, Chair. I know that got adopted.
Thank you, Honorable Mandasha. Honorable Fonseca, it's adopted. Members, last week in our committee meeting, we have agreed as the committee to make amendments on an introduced a bill, UIF bill, and we agreed on that day to reject clause 1. I take it that all the members have all the copies. There's a copy that is called a gay committee. So that copy is really a copy that first copy. That is page that is showing us exactly what is that we have rejected or amended. Do we all have that document? Okay. So that copy is called an A-list copy because it is reflecting the amendments that we have done last week. Then clause 1, let me step close. Clause rejected. Clause 4 is rejected. We have agreed on the rejection of clause 4. Are we together? Okay. And then on clause 10 of the amendment bill, we on page 4 in line 25, we have agreed to omit subsection and substitute it with subsection. All together. Okay. On page 4, from line 21, we have agreed to omit the following. Point 7. Subsection 5 does not apply to a contributor who voluntarily terminated a pregnancy. Are we together? Honorable is saying. And then clause 13 on page 5 in line 11, we have agreed to omit any and substitute with A. Agree? Okay.
Chair.
Okay. Another
sorry, just a question, a technical question. I was out of the room because Mr. Dagger was locked in the building. I was trying to help him find the venue.
Okay.
The clause 4 that's rejected, can I just get the guidance on which I locked it? Sorry, I'm just a little locked on that one. Whatever, I'm with you completely. But number 1, clause rejected, clause 4.
Introduce and go to page 3.
Yeah.
And then you read section 4 of clause 4. Do you see it?
The
minister. The minister may, where necessary, that's very well.
I'm just not 100% clear which line or which clause is being deleted.
The whole clause. Remember, Honourable, please, that clause, Honourable, please, you must understand, if we remind you, Honourable Olive, just as I want you to pay attention, if we remind you what we have done when we were in our public hearing, there was a complaint by the labor movement that these changes in this clause were not deliberated or agreed upon in NEPA. Yes. And then this department did not argue, they drew it.
So the department has withdrawn
clause
4, which is the minister may wear an SOC designated commissioner, blah blah blah.
Yes.
So the department has withdrawn.
Yes.
Yes, thank you. I just want to be clear because I'm getting into trouble.
Were you late? You are here though, but okay, we have also agreed with the imperative. Agreed, okay. Another member, now that we have agreed with the atheist, what we are going to do now, I want to and I want to go to another stage of going clause by clause in the amendment, the one that we have amended, the one that does not have the A-list item. So it's an amendment one. Now I want to go to clause by clause so that the members, if there are any objections or anything that they want to say in that clause, they can say it. Are we together? Okay, we put the GA and I want to wait for you. It's like, are you fine?
No, I'm fine. I've just got multiple copies, so I'm just taking away on the B.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Now, clause one. Are we happy with clause one? Look? Okay. I think before clause one, I submit to you the long title. The long title will be that huge paragraph there under the bill. I'm not going to read it, but I assume that the members have read and gone through it. That's the long title. Any objections to the long title? Members, can you hear? None. So if there are no hands, I will take it that there is none, and then I pass. And then let them go to the clause one. I submit clause one of the amended bill. I submit clause two of the amended bill. I don't want to leave anybody behind. Are we together? Okay. I submit clause 3 of the bill. I submit clause 4 of the bill. Clause 4, you remember, is a new one because we have already omitted the previous one. So this was clause 5 of the one that the bill that was introduced to us. Okay, so I submit clause 5. No hands. I submit clause 6. I stop. Clause 8. I submit. Clause 9. I submit. Clause 10. I submit. Clause 11. I submit. Clause 12.
Okay, but the point is that clause 10, where you made the amendment last week. So that's
Yes, everything, and I'm not on bill. What if the first one was B, the second one was B25, and this one is B25B. If you are looking there at the end of the bottom, so we are now on D25B, meaning that we are dealing with the amendment one by us. Yes, as long as we know what we are doing, we are agreeing on the amendment. So, we are still on clause 10. No, I think he understands now because we are not dealing with the old one, we're dealing with the new one. So where were we? I submit clause 11. I submit clause 12. I submit clause 13. I submit 13. I submit clause 14. I submit clause 15. I submit clause 16. I submit clause 17. I now submit clause 18, the short title. It reads as follows. This act is called the Unemployment Insurance Amendment Act 2015. I am not going to read the memorandum. The memorandum is the summary of the bill. Do we all agree to the amendments? Another copy?
Madam Chair, yes, but in the memorandum still refers to clause 13, 14, and 14. It still reads a bit clumsy.
Can I read it out? Clause 13 of the memorandum.
Clause 13 of the memorandum, page 7, unless I've got the wrong memorandum.
Under 13.14. Let us assist you. Can you read the chapter 2? Thank you, Chapter 10. Clause 13 of the bill reads as follows. It's amendment of Section 86A of Act 3 of 2001. The clause reads as follows. Minister must have a consultation with the board. Now it will read, the board must appoint the regional appeals committee for each region determined by the minister.
Wait a second. If you look at the latest version of the bill, the numbers have changed. So that on our latest version, that's why Raina was there to get a copy. The latest version, clause 12, is what used to be clause 13 on the memorandum. Something's moved up. So the clause that is actually referring to is the one which reads clause 12 is to amend section 33 of the Act by prohibiting any agency or person reporting to the acting on behalf of the applicant to charge a fee against the applicant. Am I right?
Yes.
It's called clause 12 on the latest version, but in the earlier version it refers to clause 13. So he's actually talking about what is called clause 12, 3.14, clause 12, to amend section 33. That's the one I think you're referring to.
Honourable, remember that there are certain clauses that we have removed, and therefore the numbering is going to change. Honourable, I wanted to give Honourable Lolly West, maybe she might assist.
Chair, I wanted to appear. Zwanani this morning gave us a call of the 2-5 days of 2015. For us to be on the same page, let's use that document, not the ones that were given, so that we don't get lost in the middle of the discussion.
It is in your PC. That's why we said, when you read members, if you were with us when we were reading an A list was showing us all the changes that have been made. And what is on that A list is what is on this bill 25B. So, but immediately as Honorable is saying, read on a different, if you are not reading on the same page, then you will find these mistakes. But as much as we have all agreed, you understand now. Okay.
Thank you. No,
if they understand, they'll need to
yes,
you can. No, Chair, I was going to say, where I'm seated, I don't see any contradictions between what is captured on clause 12 and what is in the end.
Yeah. Okay, well, okay. So now, are you answering the question that says, do we all agree to the amendment? Honorable Bahrain is saying yes, and Honorable Oliwe is seconding the answer. Now the committee secretary will read to you the committee report, which will be ATC'd and tabled in the National Assembly. Before Honorable Oliwe?
Thank you. Our caucus requires me to ask certain questions before we vote. And there's just two questions. It's the same question that I need to ask. I've spoken to the official from the department just in the tea bag, but I need to just get it on the record. The question that they will ask us in our caucus is, was any regulatory impact assessment done on this bill? And the second question will be, have we considered the financial implications? Now, I understand that lots of stuff has been done. So if we can just get onto the record for this meeting what the financial implications of the bill are and whether there were regulatory impact assessments. Just 4 minutes. I just need you for the minute to get the official response on the record.
Official response.
Yes.
Anyone is ready to answer questions?
Thank you, Chairperson. We would have done the assessment, it was done by the interest board, the financial implications and the impact. Those were done.
The financial impact?
Yes.
So, the reason, obviously, I have to ask is that a fund won't go bankrupt if we pay out the extra money to people. And we think it's a good idea to pay extra money to people, but we just have to check that the fund is not going to go bankrupt.
Thank you. So can the committee secretary now proceed to the reading what will be TC'd and tabled in the National Assembly? Over to your committee secretary, Mr. Sakasa.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. The report of the Portfolio Committee on Labour on the Unemployment Insurance Amendment Bill, B25 of 2015, dated 9 March 2016. The Portfolio Committee on Labour, having considered the subject of the Unemployment Insurance Amendment Bill, which is the National Assembly Section 75, refers to it and classified by the KTM as a Section 75 bill, reports the bill with Amendment B25A of 2015. Report to be considered. Thank you, Chair.
So this is what will be interceded. We all agree on that. Thank you. So we will be going to the second leg of the agenda. Okay. Maybe we can just attend for 3 minutes and allow the LSC, if they want to connect and give them that space. Honorable someone,
thank you, Mr. Person. I just wanted to check if Mr. Person adopt.
We have. Mm.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Honorable Buckling proposed and Honorable Lori West.
Chairperson, if we can just note for the minutes that the DA caucus only meets tomorrow, not today, so we have to present to our caucus. And obviously, we're not bosses. We believe that we will recommend to our caucus tomorrow that the party supports and votes in favour of this bill because we think it's a good bill. But of course, our party caucus has to be consulted. So just if you can record that, we will first need to consult our party caucus. But we as members are in favour of the bill, unless the party comes up with something we haven't thought of.
Okay. Thank you so much. I think we appreciate that one, that as members, we agree and happy and have adopted these amendments. However, on the DA, depending on what their caucus are saying, they might come back with something else, but we should understand that it is not them, but the party. No, it's not going to stop the process. I'm sure he's preparing us. If he stands up in, when we and say something different, we must understand that you be, what is the right word? It will be emanated from the caucus. I've noted you, another point. I've noted you. Oh, Lola, you want to say something on that one? It's recorded.
Thanks, Chair. We really appreciate what they have told us. But I will wish in future for emergency issues like this one, because all of us, we have been saying how we wish this can be finalized at the earliest convenience. If, for instance, they could have approached their leaders so that they give them a sense of the amendments that we proposed last week, so that we don't delay the process any further. Thank you.
Can you speak through the microphone?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Honourable W.A. We have done it last week. We have presented amendments to our caucus. We haven't taken a position yet because within credit we haven't decided yet. And I don't think that will be unnecessary delays, most certainly not.
Yes, That process is not going to send us back. Whatever the day Gokak decides for or against, we have done our process. Remember that they are part of the committee and they agree with us. So we're not going back. I think they are raising so that we should not be surprised when they are talking a different money, a different tune. Rightly so, we have agreed on this amendment, Honorable, we are right. We all agreed last week, and it was clear that today this is what we are going to present. Because all of us, without exception, we agreed. It's why there was no position taken, really, they can answer and we cannot answer. But I think we must appreciate the honesty from the members in the committee who are from the DA. That is much appreciated. Honorable, you wanted to say something, Honorable Bakhani?
No, I just wanted to thank Zolani for the hard work that has gone into this.
Oh, sorry. Just before that, I think that will be the last time. Let's allow the Honorable Member to say something. Honorable Kaula.
Thanks, not necessarily preempting what will be the caucus position or what will be the position of the SM. But I also want just for the court to know that I will also be submitting, obviously, the recommendations and the EFF will take its own position. Otherwise, in the sense, I don't see any objection. Thank you.
There's another position from the EFF. We might be. He is. It is the same route that is that we hear from members from the TA that we all agree as members. Any changes that we see, surprises that we see, we must know it is mandate from the parties. They will be doing something that they if it's not of their but from the party. We accept that. Thank you so much. Honorable Bakhani, then you can talk.
I want to thank Zolani, as I saw just now, and the hard work that he's put into it. And in particular, I want to thank the department for considering changing these regulations to help the unemployed. Because certainly at a time in our history where it's actually needed. The golden thread that runs through this amendment bill is to try and help those people that have lost their jobs. And I think we as a committee will appreciate that. And we want to express that to the department. Thank you, Madam Chair, for that.
Thank you, Honorable Bakhani. I think you've said it more than it has been. Thank you so much. Honorable Lodi, what?
Thank you, Chair. I thought you ended by then, Jacob.
We really appreciate everybody, departments. We didn't fight. Not at all. We were working like others, agreeing to disagree, hit a debate, but at the end we produced something that is good for the nation. And thank you to the parliamentary legal advisor, to the department, and to all the assistants in the committee, content, researcher, and to all members. And thank you so much. This is really a good work by a collective. Let's stand for a few minutes and allow for this presentation. This presentation member is going to assist us as well. Usually we call the appropriations committee or assessors just to assist us in terms of how the department has gone in terms of finances. And then, but they are coming next week. At least we'll be a little bit wiser in terms of the financial spending of the department, whether they have stick to now the department is released. Thank you so much. Okay. Yes.
There was some information to the commission.
Mandate is to make recommendations.
regulations and researched in Chapter 13 of the Constitution or in national legislation to parliaments, provincial legislatures, and any other organs of state determined by such legislation. Now, the recommendations of the Commission primarily focus on the equitable division of nationally collected revenue among and between or across the three spheres of government. And the Commission also make recommendations on any other financial and fiscal matter, either at the request by any organ of state across the three spheres of government like yourself, or on its own accord if it basically identifies certain challenges that are affecting the financial and fiscal system and its functioning. We can actually make those recommendations. Primarily, the recommendations are made to Parliament so that Parliament can then engage with the relevant organs of state in addressing those types of matters. Now, there are certain provisions in the legislation, either the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act or the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act, the Municipal Powers and Functions Act, Municipal Finance Management Act, or the Public Finance Management Act, that compel certain consultations to take place between organs of state and the Commission when certain decisions that have financial and fiscal implications on another sphere of government or an organ of state which is on another sphere of government that are taken by either legislation, regulation, or an executive decision are made, the Commission's recommendations must be required. And this is an amendment to the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act that came into effect in August of last year. Now, we are a commission that constitutes of nine commissioners, and they are supported by the secretariat, primarily based in Lutrent in Gauteng, but we also have a presence in Cape Town for purposes of these types of engagements with Parliament and the National Council of Provinces. I think that what I can say in a nutshell is the Commission. Let me get into the letter that we are here about. I'll just provide a background and overview of what is actually happening in the labour market in South Africa and then I will request Mr. Dawood next to me to take you through some specific issues from the department. Now, as background, that first slide basically shows you what has been happening in South Africa since 1994. You can see that bars basically represent the real growth in the economy, which is the GDP growth rate. And then we have that line there that represents employment or unemployment, or whichever way you want to look at it. So on the right hand side, we measure the growth in GDP, and then on the left, which goes at your unemployment rate. What you can see there is that section, and I think the bullet is not very accurate. It's not across this period that you see that relationship. You can see that there is a period between 2004 and around about 2008-2009 where that statement does not apply. That says there is a close association between the economic growth rate for South Africa and unemployment rate. There's a period there where the relationship is reversed. The economy is growing, but it is not having that kind of an impact on the unemployment. So there's a break somewhere that we must accept that there's a period where we had what we would call jobless growth. Yeah. So that period you can see from that picture where the economy was growing, but unemployment was also growing. So this is a problem there. We can see now, post the global economic crisis, that unemployment has been rising.
because there's been very new change. And if you actually look beyond 2014, you probably see that that graph, that average is very few. So there's a problem around this, and if we do not do anything around growth, we obviously will have a challenge in terms of things unemployment, which is a very critical issue. Now, the next slide basically shows you the proportion of jobs per sector and the annual growth also in employment. A large number of jobs we see in community and services, community services, which basically government, NGOs, and all of the trade and manufacturing sectors. The average yearly growth in manufacturing has been negative between 2008 and 2015. And I think even if one looks at the latest numbers, we could still see that there's a problem there. Now, this trend is concerning since manufacturing has been earmarked as a sector with the most employment creation opportunities. So government policy in terms of creating job opportunities is trying to boost the manufacturing sector, and if the trends that we are seeing continue, then there's a problem. So the main sources of employment that year, let me say the key driver in the employment numbers last year seems to have been agriculture, in spite of the drought and construction, obviously, in spite of the fact that if one looks at some of the submissions that we have made, especially relating to this fiscal framework, we have raised a concern around the uptake of our infrastructure programs and the slow implementation, slow spending, especially within the municipalities, which have got quite a big chunk of allocations to deal with the infrastructure backlogs, maintenance, and new infrastructure. So the spending is very slow. So construction is one of those sectors that have got higher job creation potential. Is also not moving as fast as you would like to see. This graph shows the quarterly scenario around employment, and it's also showing the challenges that that we have been facing. Albeit that in the last quarter, the numbers of 2015, the numbers show some positive scenario. 250,000 increase in formal sector employment on a quarter-on-quarter basis in quarter four. Now, this chart here basically illustrates the relationship between demand, output, and employment for each sector. To interpret it, what you are saying, for example, if you take agriculture, what you're saying is that a million rand extra output in the agricultural sector would result in an overall increase in output of 1.7 million in the economy and will create potentially 4.9 jobs. So if we look at the different sectors there, we can actually pick all the sectors that have got the highest potential to create jobs and therefore the highest potential for investment in order to generate growth. So that's what that chart is showing. Now, we also have put in a chart there that shows you what is actually happening in terms of population dynamics. There is a strong shift in population towards urban areas, and that basically means that we need to look quite closely to what is happening in our urban areas and our cities in particular, because most of this shift in population dynamics is basically moving into our metropolitan areas. And so they need to find strategies to deal with these pressures that our urban areas, in particular our large cities and metropolitan areas, to deal with these issues. And it's still the role of government and what government does with resources that Now, the National Development Plan recognizes job creation as a key driver for accelerated growth and the higher standard of living, and it has the following targets: to reduce the unemployment rate to 40% by 2020 and 6% by 2030, to increase the number of people employed to 23.8 million, and independently, therefore increasing the percentage of the working age population employed to 61%. Now, let me say that the current scenario that we are witnessing of low growth in the economy is a major challenge to achieving these types of targets that the National Development Plan envisages. So if we cannot accelerate growth in the economy to the levels that are assumed in the NDP, then this ECA will change. Definitely we will not be able to meet the types of so if the current trends persist and we do not we are not able to generate a faster economic growth, which I would say is a serious challenge, but it's not insurmountable with the right choice of policies. We should be able to accelerate growth, but this target basically are becoming elusive given the current scenario. Hopefully things will change for better. To achieve this goal, the NDP highlights the following: capabilities of the workforce must be improved. Bargaining and labor relations should be stabilized in a manner which is conducive to investment. To raise the economy to higher growth levels, the structure of the South African economy needs to move away from resource intensive to more energy efficient labor absorptive industries. We need to support economies with higher potential for job creation and benefits for other sectors in the economy. So it's the choice of the sectors that will drive economic growth and also be able to create jobs. Now, this matter of capabilities of the workforce creates a challenge in terms of the capacity of the economy or to achieve a certain of its targets. Part of the challenge with our infrastructure programs, for example, is as a result of a shortage or a lack of skills. So even though you can allocate the money to do certain things, make the resources available, we find that we get back the money. We have not spent the money that we have. So there must be an issue around the absorptive capacity of the economy, and part of the challenge is the skills research in the workforce. So those are issues that we need to look at. So the labor market is confronted with a number of critical challenges that need to be addressed if the economy is going to create the level of jobs and business at the NDP. Now, so the skills research have already alluded to. Now, part of the issues that we raised in our submission last year, our annual submission, which tabled in May, was to look at how we can measure productivity and link compensation of employees to be linked to the productivity that is actually generated. There's a lot of conversations that are taking place around the outcomes in our education system. There are some scary numbers that have been presented. Somebody presented a number the other day that says 60% of all students that enter first year university, 60% of them fail. Very, very disturbing statistic. But the real challenge is how do we get the outcomes in the education system to reflect the resources that are actually put into that system. Similar questions can be raised around our healthcare outcomes. And those two social spending areas constitute a significant amount of the budget, constitute a significant amount of actually spent by government in trying to address some of the challenges that the economy faces and the significant implications for our skill set and our workforce. So there is something that needs to happen there. Now, there have been issues that have been raised by economists that have argued around labor legislation as remaining restrictive by global standards. At the FSC, we have not actually conducted any significant research in terms of what the legislation itself means, but there are certain issues that have to deal with the regulations, which is how you implement the legislation. And so there are issues around regulations which might actually need to be looked at, the regulation of the labor market. These are issues that will require significant empirical evidence to justify them as being a significant factor. There are a lot of adversarial relationships in terms of collective bargaining and negotiation for compensation for employees, and those are issues that can be addressed without necessarily changing legislation. We don't think that we have sufficient evidence. Maybe these economists that raise those issues have the evidence. But let me hand over to Mr. Dawes to just go through the specifics with the department.
Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning, members of the committee. So I'll just quick up through some of the spending data and performance information as requested by the committee. So the first part will basically look at what is actually going to be the allocation to the departments over the 2016-2017 year. And then after that, we'll go into quarter two and quarter three performance. So just to provide an overview for the department, we know that the department has four main programs, and there are five entities that report to the department. The main focus for the department over the medium term, 26 medium term, in line with the NDP, relates to minimum working conditions, fair labor practices, supporting work seekers and regulating the workplace. Now, in terms of the medium term strategic framework, the department contributes to outcome 4, which relates to decent employment through inclusive growth. Now, when we look at the 2016-17 NTA framework, what we see is that in nominal terms, the department's budget is increasing from 2.8 billion in 2016-17, rising to 3.2 billion in 2018-2019. But when you compare the historical spending patterns from 2012-13 to 2015-16 this year, and you relate that to the 2016 NTA period, we see that there is quite a big disjuncture that is taking place over here. And that largely is a result of the lower national aggregate expenditure ceilings. So when you compare the first year, which is the past 4 years, we see that expenditure growth has been 4.2% for the department. Over the 2016-17 period, that's contributed to 0.1%. So it's not negative growth, it's still positive growth, and here we're talking about growth about the inflation. So in the real terms, the department is growing, but at a very low rate. So typically, if the department were to continue with what it's currently doing, it should still be able to do within the current resources, as the actual budget itself has not been decreased in the real terms. Now, if we look at the breakdown of spending by programs, this will give us a sense of where the prioritization is taking place within the department. We see that the bulk of the resources are allocated to the administration program and also labor policy and industrial relations. And here, the blue bar represents the period from 2012 to 2015-16, so for the past 4 years, and the red bar represents the allocations over 2016-18 period. So essentially, the allegations are going to remain more or less the same in terms of the spread across the programs, but what we do find is that there's a slight increase in labor policy and industrial relations, that's program 4, which highlights the priority attached to the implementation of various labor legislation and national minimum wage. So in order to implement this, they are putting 12 critical posts in the particular program. Now moving on to looking at the allocations with respect to the economic classification or your specific line items. The cabinet approved deductions are evident with respect to your transfers and subsidies, goods and services and compensation. Those are your three main, the bulk of your resources allocated to those three line items. However, despite the reduction that is evident over the 2016 MTA period, you still find that compensation is going to grow in positive terms, as well as goods and services is going to be growing in positive terms over the 2016 MTA period. Although what we do find is that there is a real reduction in transfers and subsidies by minus 0.2%. Moving on in terms of looking at where the allocations or rather the spending spread across the line items, as I indicated earlier, bulk of it lies in compensation of employees as well as transfers and subsidies. And the panel is considering very bullish the same over the 2016 MTA period, with slight increase in compensation as well as transfers. Now, just to recap on the spending controls of the department in 2014-15 and the committee might be aware of this coming out of the annual report assessment that took place last year, but just as a point of departure to what was happening in 2014-16, what we find was that when we look at the two previous financial years, there actually been a worsening of underspending by the department. It went from 97% in 2013-14 95% in 2014-15. And the underspending took place across most of the programs, but in 2014-15 specifically, underspending was largely concentrated in the administration program, where they spent 84-88% of the total budget. Now, the reasons for the underspending that were identified by the department included Department of Public Works invoicing per month significantly less than budgeted for, and claims on the compensation front was less than anticipated. So those are the reasons that the department provided in the annual report. Just to highlight some aspects that were raised by the Auditor General, with respect to the audit opinion, the department claim received an unqualified report for the past three financial years, both emphasis on matter. And really the emphasis of matter related to material understanding as indicated in the previous slide, performance information that were not specific. But also the IG highlighted issues around lack of effective steps taken to avoid illegal expenditure as required by the DMA. Also, the IG indicated that the accounting office did not be complete, accurate and reliable financial statements that are supported by reliable evidence. So despite all of these issues, despite the fact that the department was an unqualified report, there is also an issue that were highlighted for areas of improvement that the department needed to experience. Now, moving on to the second and third quarter performance assessment for the department in 2015-2016. This particular slide looks at the performance assessment for the second quarter of 2014-16. What we see there is that the department achieved 60% of its targets for the targets that were supposed to be achieved in the second quarter. So the underachievement of targets were across all of the four programs, but specifically in administration, which achieved 47% of its targets in 2015 in the second quarter, and the public employment services, which achieved 44%. We will move on to look at the third quarter performance of the department for 2015-16. Again, we see that the department achieved 46% of its performance targets, so more or less similar to the achievement in the same quarter. In this quarter, public employment services again achieved 44% of its targets, while labor policy and industrial relations achieved only 22%. So what we see there is over the second and the third quarter is a significant underachievement of the targets by the department, but specifically employment services, which achieved less than 50% of its targets in both quarters. Now, looking at achieving third outcomes of some performance indicators. So for example, they are indicators that are used, like the example that we've got, the processing work pieces are part of the focus within 30 days. And quite often the department struggles to meet those turnaround times. In this particular instance, the department achieved a 41% processing of users within a 30-day period. Now, the problem could be that what needs to be looked at is to identify whether the work processes of the department actually lead themselves to achieving a 30-day turnaround time. And the areas that may need to be assessed could be any overlaps, duplication, as well as bottlenecks in the system. Also, what we found was most programs did not include any spending information, even though this is a requirement in terms of the quarterly performance template. So we had performance information for all of the programs, but when we looked at what was spent on each program and what was spent per performance indicator, most programs and most reports indicated did not have this information. Therefore, assessing whether spending by the programs were in line with quarterly projections would therefore not be done. What we also found was that there were big differences reported of critical indicators that related to good governance and employment creation. For example, indicators around disciplinary and court cases, finance, or team time, such as implicit, work seekers, and employment. We found that there were big differences between what was planned and what was actually achieved. Now, with respect to placing work seekers in employment, the fact that they could be, because the labor market is not creating as much jobs, because of the low growth, the department is struggling to achieve its targets. So that could be a reason why the typical variance is for that particular indicator. Some indicators may not take into account the need to control expenditures to achieve cost savings as highlighted in Budget 2016. And we know that the Minister of Finance, when he tabled this budget a few weeks ago, emphasized the need to identify cost savings in the department. And what we picked up was that there may be instances where the department may not be identifying these cost savings in its current implementation. And here's the example that we identified was that the Department of Labor is aiming to reduce its vacancy rate from 12%, which is to 8% by the end of 2015-2016. Currently, the department has a vacancy rate of 1,062. So in order for it to achieve that 8% vacancy rate, it would need to reduce that vacancy to 701. What we would like to highlight here is that irrespective of whether the department achieves that target by the end of the fourth quarter, what remains unclear is whether the department assesses the financial viability of achieving this target within the available resource envelope. So does the department have the financial resources available to recruit those additional resources? In addition, the Department of Labor needs to weigh up whether the staff establishment size is affordable and consistent with the allocations over the 2016 MTEC period. So does the department have the resources to absorb all of the vacancies that are currently on the staff establishment? And is that the current staff establishment affordable in terms of the resources? I know when you look at the 2016 MTEC projections, growth is close to zero for the department. As a chief, what we did here was we basically looked at the in-year spending performance. So how does the department spend by quarter? And we looked at the past three financial years, including the 2015-2016 financial year. What we found was that between quarter one and quarter three, which are those three bars towards the left, the department spends always in line with the straight line norm, if you like. Straight line norm says by the end of the third quarter, you should be able to spend at least 75% of your budget. And the department in all 3 years consistently spends about the 75%. But when you come to the end of the financial year, which are the bars on the far right, the blue bar indicates the total spending in 2013-14 and the red bar indicates the total spending in 2014. So what we find is that despite the fact that the department spends in line with the straight line law in the first three quarters, by the end of the year, the department is underspending. when you look at quarter four, you actually find that that is actually where the underspending actually takes place, so the low spending of the department actually takes place. For 2013, 2014, and 2015. 2016, of course, we've not yet reached the end of that quarter, so we don't really know what the spending in the quarter four is going to be. But up until the end of quarter three, in 2015-16, the department had spent 78% of its budget. Now, the reason why the department has consistently spent above the norm, deadline norm, is because there are two large transfers that are affected to the CCM in the first three quarters. And from 2017-2018, the department will change its transfer system by spreading those transfers across the four quarters in order to smooth out the spending patterns over the four quarters. Now, actually, moving on to looking at the agencies that report to the Department of Income. As you know, there are five entities that report to the Department of Income. Four of those entities receive transfers, and one entity, the URF, do not receive any transfer payments from the Department of Income. Eventually, in our submission for the 2050 appropriation bill that was last year, May, June, the Commission called on the Department of Labour to play a more active role in the oversight of the compensation fund. And the context of this comment was as a result of poor audit outcomes by the public entity and also significant expenditure hikes which we observed for 2014-15. As a result of compensation claims in excess of 200% of the budget allocated. Now, the Commission welcomes the subsequent establishment of a task team by the Minister of Labour and the implementation of a system that will account for all of the benefits that will pay. We also looked at the performance of the other four entities that report to the Department of Labour, and what we found was that all of the other entities either received unqualified audit or unqualified audit was title of emphasis. We didn't pick up any significant overspending observed, although the CCM did overspend by 2% in 2013-14, but subsequent years we saw the spending was more than in line with the purposes that were allocated. Okay, just to wrap up, Madam Chair, with some concluding remarks. We know that the NPP sets ambitious targets of job creation for the South African economy. With the economy was expected to decline over the MTS period, allocation to the Department of Labour is going at a slow pace compared to previous years. Now, if the macroeconomy is going to continue its current trajectory, which is a low growth, what we may see is that there could be further cuts to the department's baseline allocations. Now, the department has received unqualified audit from the AG for the past year, but there are aspects that require attention. The first issue that we've identified is the spending and performance of departments, specifically in the fourth quarter. Performance reports will not capture spending data as required by the quarterly template. And then also, all programs underperform over both quarters, specifically the employment services, which was the worst performer of one of these programs. Also, we'd like to raise the issue that the Department of Labour mainly persists affordability of its staff establishment in relation to allocations over the 2016 MTS period. Coordination between the Department of Labour and also other national departments that are implementing job creation programs need to be strengthened so that we avoid issues of duplication and overlaps, but also at the same time we are improving synergies across these different programs. Better reporting in the speed of spinning data is required, but also and also finally the Commission would like to highlights that the department needs to exercise, continue to exercise effective oversight over the compensation fund until all audit queries raised by the AG in its 2014-15 report have effectively been addressed.
I think we want to stop the presentation here. At the back, we want to ask like a few recommendations that the Commission has made over the years that might be of importance in your engagement with the department in terms of the efforts in particular. Most of those recommendations
before I give the members an opportunity to talk, do you, are they responding positively to your recommendation? Are you happy with the rate of response? And if you say no, what do you think is the problem? Is it the problem that cannot be that in the department itself that you need to, what do you say?
For
50%, is it 50% of the responses or 90? At least if you can rate the responses, what percentage?
What I can say, Chair, in respect of this particular department, is you would be aware that the response to the recommendations of the Commission is a response by government. In other words, cabinet must take a decision on the response that the Minister of Finance will enter. I think what is more important is that we check that government has responded in this particular way to this recommendation. We should then be able to come back and say, in terms of implementation,
sorry, TA, because you're too loud. It's softer.
Yeah, we can then come back and say which ones have been implemented. The general response by government to the Commission's recommendations has been very positive. I think in the last 5 years, the past 5 years, are probably working on around about 97% acceptance of the recommendations. But the trick is now the implementation of those recommendations does not fall squarely on the Minister of Finance. Each department must then start implementing those recommendations within its broader program. Some of them, you might make a recommendation today, but it requires a longer period to implement. So it might take 3 years, it might take 5 years. Recommendations tend to be over the MTEF. We can assess at the end of the MTEF whether these recommendations, if anything has been done, which aligns itself to this type of a recommendation. We haven't done that for this department in this presentation that we've made for you, but we can actually check. It's very easy to track these things.
Members? Any clarity? Honorable Mandash? Honorable Austin? Is your hand up on America? Yes. Did you say yes?
Yes.
Okay, so in that order, I think Honorable Mandash, Honorable Bahrain, and Honorable Miller, America.
Thank you, Jefferson. In appreciating this report or presentation, I just want to go to one clarity seeking question, because the rest are very explanatory. And I appreciate the fact that they recognize that between the years 2004 to 2009, there was growth and unemployment did not match each other, because when there's growth, employment should be increased, but that did not happen in those years. And I would assume because of the recession. But one question that I'm having for you is that in the role that you say it is your role as a commission, you say on the last paragraph, legislative provisions affect decisions that affect either provincial or local government from a financial perspective. And I want to pose the question, where will you, or what are you doing when the National Treasury is retracting money from poor provinces because they have not performed, because they say that sometimes poor performance is linked to skill scarcity in those areas. What is your intervention? Because I was listening today to the media saying almost a huge sum of amount of money was going to be retracted from the Department of Education in the Eastern Cape to be given to provinces that are well off that province. And what is the intervention that this commission can do to avert that decision, because it is taking the province to a south position other than the treasury, reinforcing skills to ensure that the fiscal spending is improved. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm congratulating some of the issues. If we can first have a look,
If we're going to have a look, obviously a lot of your recommendations are based on the growth, and you've heard what the Minister of Finance has said about what the growth is, and in fact it looks like it's going to be even less than what it is. So I presume, I mean, you put a caveat on it, saying that these figures won't be reached if the growth drops. And now that you've seen what the growth actually is, and it's dropped, I presume you're going to be, amending these forecasts, and you're going to have a look at it again. And they just go through, my papers. I see also that there's been, if you have a look at page 8, program shift, total spending budget, it's pretty small for inspection and enforcement services. And in fact, there's no growth expected in that. I think it says on 18% in that particular one. Do you think that there should be further growth in that, inspection, and you want to comment on it? And I see there's been a lot of money spent, you're maybe reporting on it, but there's a lot of money spent on labour policy and industrial relations. It's the largest part of the budget. That, of course, doesn't produce anything at all. And maybe you want to comment on that. But go down, lower down in that page, where it says effective cabinet approved reductions evident, particularly transfers and subsidies, food services, and compensation. Again, you're saying that the wage inspectors and employment councils are expected to increase in line with the increased demand for these services. Again, we have a comment on that, and maybe you want to comment on it. If we can go to page 9, the claims from the compensation fund are less than anticipated. That sounds good, except that's critical, because in essence they're just not activating claims. The claims are coming in, and thousands of them, but they're not activating at all. Maybe that ought to skew your figures as well. If I can go to page 11, 21, you're saying that the administration at 53% didn't achieve. That's clearly a fault of the staff. It's not an external fault. Maybe you want to comment on that. And the same for public employment services at 56%. Didn't achieve. That's in the second quarter, and it's reflected again in the third quarter, where labour policy and industrial relations, which is a high spend, but 78% non-achievement. And maybe you want to comment on that as well. I'm looking at slide 23, and you said this under program 3 employment services, and we're talking about major challenges. Where there was real achievement in terms of processing work visas or foreign workers within 30 days. You make that comment, but I'm not sure why you're making that comment. I mean, that is a point that needs to be made. Last department isn't that they failed. But I'm not sure why you're making a comment over there, what line are you saying. Also on page 12, slide 24, big variances reported for critical indicators related to good governance and employment creation. We keep hearing about that, and you're saying that they take your advice, but in essence, the department in the past has had exactly the same report made. It's all very well to say, we take your advice, we hear you, and then actually do nothing about it. It seems to be getting worse. So I'm not sure what you have any influence on that whatsoever. And then you ask 74 as to whether there's a financial viability of achieving the target. In other words, they've got jobs vacant, but whether they've got the money for it, shouldn't you be telling them whether they have or not? I don't know. Who actually makes that decision as to whether they have the money or not? I mean, are you not going to comment on that?
Very much. I'm just having a look at my notes.
And of course, the compensation fund at slide 29, again, it indicates a major problem. And I don't actually see that reflected at all. The compensation fund has failed in its entirety. And then I can finally just refer to slide 41 of page 16, where you talk about the coordination between the Department of Labor and other national departments. Well obviously that is absolutely required, and I'm not sure who tries to coordinate that, whether you give any advice or someone has an overview as the eagle flies, because obviously they need to be talking to the small business departments as well. But whether they do in fact or not, well, has ever recommended it, and whether you should be looking at it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think after Honourable Bergman, I went to stop myself concerned because I think he covered most of what I was going to raise, and perhaps in future as to restrict Honourable Bergen to one or two questions to allow us also to participate. I mean, it is Madam Chair. I think that the two matters I want to emphasize and describe earlier is that given the needs for increased job creation, another performing program such as employment services, not that the being assisted in that regard to achieve our objectives as identified in the NDP. I want to say further that if I look at the budget allocation for administration and compared with the previous financial year, is not much, it's a marginal increase. And yet we have a vacancy rate of 12% and then the department visits to you to 8%. We need to increase the total staff establishment given the little growth in the administration program, let alone trying to fill additional 701 positions, and whether those positions are funded or not. And then lastly, Madam Chair, we've had the understanding problems that some departments may have or entities may have. It could possibly be, it's rollovers that may take place in the fourth quarter, or is it due to planning gaps, and then that result in requisitions and procurement choices, and this is only activated within the last term, and hence the particular expenditure may not be completed during that particular term and subsequently roll over. Then finally, if one looks at the recommendations, and I mean all of those recommendations are particularly geared towards what are the structural shortcomings in terms of within the department and the entities that need to be sort of unblocked to create jobs and meaningful recommendations are made, but if you look here, I may have missed it due to my private conversation with my colleague, is that to what extent are the department
government, and if it is alive to those recommendations that you spent, and do you have any sort of leverage to nudge them towards taking those recommendations seriously? Thank you, Madam Chair.
It will respond to one question and then we'll allow you to respond and if there are further questions we'll do after your response. Wonderful, Lollywood.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, mine is just one question, which is an interesting and small footnote on page 12, slide 23, where the Commission is saying assessing web spending by programs were in line with quarterly projection could therefore not be determined. Then what informs the paragraph that you are shown on the pages that will receive that information will be provided? It was not necessary.
I've noted your terms, the details, but just give them an opportunity to answer.
Okay. Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think some of the questions, I must say that I cannot answer them because it's really the department that can give you those answers. You get the information and put it together. And where we need the clarity from them, we had a conversation we have with the CFO of the department. And so we just be. So I will respond to some of the questions and then I'll ask Khalif to respond to the questions that relate to the numbers that have been raised. First of all, I think the issue that was raised by the honorable member, not us, is a question that says why, I think the fundamental issue is what do you do in a situation where you have a tight fiscal framework, you allocate resources and those resources are not utilized, because one of the things that we should keep at the back of our minds is that there's an opportunity cost in resources that are not spent. Now, when a department is failing to spend, and I think I must say unequivocally that as the Commission, we have been a champion of shifting the money, but keeping it within the sector, and ensuring that you put in measures that will ensure that this department that is failing to spend resources that are allocated to it is capacitated in order to do that. So if it grants money, for example, let's say the conditional grant that's allocated for the equitable share for a province, it's very rare that you will take that. And the discretion, it belongs to the province, so you can only take it under very, very difficult circumstances. You need to invoke such exceptions of the Constitution in order to evolve your situation. But if you have grants, those grants are meant for certain priorities that have been identified as being of critical importance by government. So if we allocate grants to a province and the province is not spending that grant, the first thing to do is to take it and reallocate it to somebody else and address the challenges. So it's not leaving that province. It still belongs to the province, it's just that in that particular year it had to be taken away because the province failed. I'll use an example of which is quite recent in the media. You would know, you would be aware that Nelson Mandela Bay Metropolitan Municipality has recently been allocated a significant amount of money for human settlements that has been taken away from Gauteng. And that means that the primary objective of that grant is to roll out human settlements. So that money has not left the sector. It is still used to achieve this target that we have for addressing human settlements. So taking money away does not mean that permanently we have money. It's just to say where can we best utilize these resources without losing it for the particular sector. So it's
organized elsewhere, reallocated elsewhere, sort out the challenges on the ground, and then it's important that the department that controls the grants is then involved as a central mechanism to address the capacity. If it's a capacity issue in Eastern Cape education, then the National Department of Education, Basic Education, would then have to come in and assist in addressing that side of the challenge. So I think it's not taking away money to say, you have failed, so you're not going to have this anymore. It's in order that we can actually spend the money within that particular setup for which the money has been allocated. So as the Commission, again, I must say that this issue of helping and reallocating is something that we championed into the division. And we are very happy, basically, with the way in which it's been implemented. It has never been implemented in a way that says we must punish. It has been implemented in a way that brings to the attention of the relevant officials. And one thing that we had not built into the Division of Revenue Act was the responsibility of the National Transferring Officer for the particular grant in terms of the lack of capacity and their responsibility in terms of ensuring that capacity is on the ground in order that the resources can be absorbed in the year in which they are appropriated. The second set of questions that come from, I don't know whether I'm pronouncing your name properly, Honorable Bagren. Okay. Bagren. The issue around the targets, those NDP targets are set in the National Development Plan on the basis of certain assumptions about the performance of the economy. And you will recall that the National Development Plan basically was came into effect 2012 after we had the diagnostic report, which identified all sorts of areas that needed attention. Then we had the National Development Plan. But it coincided with that period of the global economic crisis. You would recall that we have just had something called the New Growth Path, which also set its own targets in terms of where, if we do certain things, where growth will actually take us in terms of the numbers. So those projects, if I were to call them, they assume certain things about the impact of the global economic crisis, the recovery of the global economic crisis, and also the response of the South African economy to the global economic crisis. Now, the Financial and Fiscal Commission, at the onset of the global economic crisis, tabled three scenarios. I think Honorable Terry will still remember that conversation that we had, where we tabled three scenarios, with one that we call business as usual, which means that South Africa, at that time, we were seeing this very nice growth, and we were on a very good growth path. So we can decide that, no, the impact of the global economic crisis is not going to have that significant of an impact on the South African economy. So we continue as if nothing has happened. So it's a business as usual. You got the trend that we had three crises, which was very nice and rosy. Then we had one that we said was going to be a severe, where we say the growth path will significantly deviate from what you were having, the trends, which is the business as usual. It deviates because it responds immediately to the crisis. So it deviates and goes down, and it went down, negative, in fact. So it goes down, and then it recovers. So it gives maybe 2-3 years to recover, and then it goes back to where it originally was. Now, under SFVA, which means the crisis and the recovery by the global economy is elongated, it's low, it then impacts on a number of countries, it means that the South African economy will
not return to the original growth path. So which means that there is something that must happen in terms of the structure of the economy. So the assumption that we have in the new growth path, the assumption that we have in the national development plan, might need to be revised if you had to go back to what you wanted. So you might want to revise those targets. Maybe you can revise the dates by which you want to achieve that goal. Because the crisis has resulted in a completely deviated way from the normal growth path. It has caused some of the structural weaknesses which the National Development Plan actually identifies of the economy. So it does identify those structural weaknesses in the economy and what needs to change, what sectors we must focus on. The NGP does that very well. So that's the impact of the global economic crisis. I think in South Africa, probably a second boost that was a moderate impact of the global economic crisis on the South African economy. But unfortunately, it turned out to be the severe, because it exposed our reliance on commodities, and what happens in the commodity market has a very significant implication for the South African economy in its current structure. Our dependency on imports, you can see, normally when you have a depreciating exchange rate, if your demand for imports is normal, there must be some form of expenditure switching, people moving away from imported manufactured products into local manufactured products. That is why manufacturing is identified as one of those areas that we need to focus on if we need to put South Africa on a new dimension in terms of growth. So it's important that those, what we would call expenditure switching effects of the exchange rate, are not actually working. In fact, our import bill is growing. Our export take is also not growing as fast as one would expect when you have a depreciating exchange rate. But that is because of depressed global demand for our exports, which tend to be commodities. And that is the problem that the economy faces. And that is why you would listen to people talking about, you know, a structural reforms to the economy that is like far-reaching type. So you're right. These numbers, yeah. Obviously, they are focused, so you can always refocus and recalibrate the... let me see, what the other one, I think that I must respond to from you before I ask Khalid to come back. The issue around the sufficiency of funding for vacancies, I think it's important to reiterate what the Minister of Finance when he tabled the budget indicated. One, there is no money over the MTF for new fancy programs. So there were priorities that were identified as those programs, that priority programs that must be funded in that country, and part of that relates to the social wage, pushing the poor and vulnerable from the impact of fiscal consolidation. Now, fiscal consolidation, in this particular instance, part of the area that you are saying you have lowered the expenditure ceiling. And when you lower the expenditure ceiling, it means you have adjusted the baseline allocations. So somebody who has this type of an establishment and has this number of vacancies, you are not suddenly going to say, no, I've got this number of vacancies and I need to fill them. You need to rethink. Because the resources to do a lot of things that you would want to do, given the current fiscal situation, the resources are not probably available. Part of the challenge that the state is faced with is its compensation budget, the amount of resources that go to compensate employees, which is the state's budget. I did try to raise the point about leading productivity to compensation. So it's an unpopular proposition, but it's not an unreasonable proposition. because increases in productivity also contribute, or improvements in productivity also contribute to better outcomes for economic growth. And if we are really serious about targeting growth as a key target that fiscal policy must be looking at in terms of pulling the economy out of the crisis and dealing with the unemployment challenges that we have, we have to accept that those are the decisions that need to be taken. Now, there is work that is done by the Presidential Remuneration Review Commission, I said in that commission myself, which also relates to these types of conversations around the vacancies, the state, how the state is structured. Do we need, for example, let me just use a crude example. In government, there is a director general, a deputy director general, a chief director, a director. So you tell me, you have this structure. Now, these things are replicated literally in every department, irrespective of whether you actually need those types of people. You have structures that look like this is a template structure, and so we must actually have people in these offices, even if it's unnecessary to have those people. We have raised issues around the type of people that you must be employing. We're saying the type of people that you must be employing are frontline, service delivery, relevant people. But there's a lot of these other people that are there that are in the chief director or deputy director general, they are directors, they are all sitting there. They do their work through services of consultants, which means you will pay this guy for being the chief director, and then he will take some money from the department which and pay somebody for being a consultant. In the meantime, there's no one who is doing the actual job on the ground. So these are types of issues that you actually have when you start interrogating the issue of productivity in the public sector and linking it to the wage bill. So it's not about the salaries that you pay, but it's about the value that the salaries that you pay are generating for the state. And if you put everybody is just an administrator and you're a consultant, and then there's no one to actually implement it. You have the nice reports and everything, you have nice policies and you put them there, but there's no one to implement. Then a problem. Because after 3 years, you must review these policies and call the same guy, you give them the money. And so you have that type of an issue, because it's reflected in your compensation budget. As you have this number of people, you're paying this much, and then you have the services that you're supposed to be delivering. You have that. So that is the conversation that we're trying to bring in, when we say, do you have sufficient resources to hire this more number of people? The minister stopped short, and I don't think he stopped short. He actually did indicate that we need to freeze. We need to freeze certain vacancies that we have, unless they are critically important, that this department cannot deliver services without this type of a person. So it's a very clear statement that says we need, if we have plans that we are going to hire this many number of people, we need to take a step back and say, under the current conditions, and so for the next 3 years, the next MTA, are we going to be able to do this realistically? So that question that we are leaving, whether we can't tell them that we don't have enough, because they will see that there's a budget constraint when they have taken certain decisions, and there is no money to see. What used to happen is that people create these vacancies and they fill them in. And now, because there was money in the system, you could then come back and say, no, but we have to do this, and then there's an adjustment budget, you get paid. Those days are over. So it's a question of like dealing with these decisions in a very hard way. The issue of how do we coordinate the effort and synergize the work around job creation, I think my answer basically would be to say Chapter 3 of the Constitution speaks about cooperative governance. So it's the responsibility of those that lead the different departments to be able to see that what they are doing. And this approach, outcome-based approach, basically tells us something. It's a structure in terms of how we need to operate. So we can't just have it as ministers already so responsible for this outcome, but in terms of our contracts with our heads of departments or directors general, our contracts do not reflect how the work in this department that's contributing to this outcome is linked to the outcome. Because that's how you optimize on the utilization of resources. So it's something that one can say, you must go and talk to so-and-so. The way in which the service delivery model of government is structured is in such a way that it is instructive in terms of how the work should be structured. So the work of the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation would probably speak to those types of issues in terms of how best do we coordinate these things. And I would maybe say that a department that you might want to have a conversation with around that issue. Let me, Honourable Chair, ask Khalif to just speak to some of the questions that relate to the numbers in the session.
Thank you, sir. Okay, so there was a question about the allocation of resources to some of the programs. It was indicated that with respect to the allocation across the various programs, should there not be more funds allocated to inspection and enforcement services, which currently receives 80% of the total allocation, compared to labor quality and industrial emissions, which receives the highest allocation of 34% over 2016 and all the way that as the way that the department would allocate the resources is based upon its work plan for the year and over the next 3 years. And so what they will do is they will obviously look at what is contained within the annual performance plan. And based upon what is contained in the annual performance plan, they will then allocate the resources according to the various programs. The question one needs to ask is, in terms of the annual performance plan, to what extent is it aligned with the priorities for the medium-term strategic framework, and specifically outcome 4, which is to, employment creation. So when the department tables its annual performance plan, it's going to be happening quite soon now, one was wanting to indicate whether it's in alignment with the medium-term strategic framework, and whether the work processes or work plans for the department is actually consistent with the demand that we require in the labor market. Then there was a question about slide 23. Why are we specifically making a comment about the working leaders? The point there was essentially to highlight that the department has quite a few indicators that are time-bound. Now that's actually a very good quality to have within the performance indicator, because it emphasizes the performance condition of the department. So they have to achieve a performance indicator within 30 days, within 60 days. Now, I could have taken any indicator, but the reason I took this particular one was simply to show that there is a relationship between achieving those performance targets and outcomes in the economy. So if a department is, for example, not going to achieve some of these outcomes at the time condition, it could have a negative impact on the economy in terms of investment, in terms of job creation, etc. There was also a question about variances between with some of the big indicators. Can we comment on some of this? Now, I think this is an important question to ask. Usually when the department reports on these variances, now when there's a big variance that's reported, now normally more than 2 to 5% is considered big variance. But in this case, they are suggested there's a significant gap. What should happen is the department should, the management of the department should put in place actions that would address those specific variances. Now, these quarterly reports are supposed to be a management report specifically in order to avoid a situation. And when you come to the end of the year, you have these significant variances attached, because you pick it up in quarter one, you pick it up in quarter two. management makes a decision in terms of how to teach those cadences, and then accordingly you start seeing the situation improving. But if you start seeing these big differences in quarter three, one needs to ask the question, is management putting in place an action plan to address those differences? And the issue of coordination was answered by the chairperson. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There were two things. I think before I can give an opportunity for follow-up, let me give opportunity to the hands, Honorable Olix and Honorable Haula, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. On page 3 of our presentation, which I think is slide 5, you show a relationship between GDP and unemployment. I'm interested to know why you're using the narrow definition of unemployment. The former governor of the Reserve Bank made it very clear that that's just ridiculous to use the narrow definition. It's something that we in South Africa invented to make ourselves look better. Everywhere in the world, they quote the full unemployment figure. Would we call the expanded? It's not expanded at all, it's the truth. I don't know why we're not using this narrow definition. 10% higher than that red line you put on there. I mean, that's just, you know, it just makes us look like we're a little bit less worse than we really are, which I think is just stupid. Then if we can just turn over two pages. Sorry, Chair, I made marks here. I wanted to ask a question. I think this question, I suppose I should address to the Chair rather than to the officials. It says here on page 10, the accounting officer does not take effective steps to avoid irregular expenditures by the PFMA. I really think I can ask the people presenting today what the answers are about that and what we can do about that. I suppose we should do talk to the department or the DG or the minister. I'm sure you will give us guidance as to how, because I mean, they won't be able to tell us what the department is going to do to fix it. So I'm not sure how to address it. We should address that question to the department, so perhaps they will come and answer that. The department only achieving 60% of their targets. I mean, I also want to know why. But again, I don't think I can ask the people who are presenting them. We need to ask the department why they're only achieving 60% of their targets on page 11. That's just shocking. And then I also want to come to this visa crisis, but I have a different question. I'm glad that you report these statistics because it gives us the real information of what is going on in the department. I don't think you should be apologetic about giving us those numbers. You should in fact give us more because we need to know what's going on. The 41% achievement in quarter two, is that quarter two of this financial year maybe just about finished? Which would mean it's June, July, August. Is that the quarter? Because the figure, the last figure we got from the department in terms of last year was that they achieved that versus 46 or 42%, I can't remember exactly, of the corporate visas, and about 68%, I think, of the individual visas. Now, I mean, I just like more information. 41% in quarter two, what happened in quarter three and quarter four, and what is the average for the year? I mean, that's just a problem. The government's not processing. It's not talking about whether they said yes or no to the visa. It's whether or not they opened the file. They only opened 41% of the file. I mean, that's a major problem, and we need more information. Again, these disciplinary and court cases, we have time frames on page 12, but then circles we need to ask the department that I can't ask the gentleman who presented the case. And the quarter four lack of spend, also they're indicating we need to ask the department that. So I think we need to have an opportunity to ask the department those sorts of questions. And the same thing is repeated on page 15. Okay, I think that's my question.
I think more or less covered some of the things I wanted to raise. I think that I agree with, but I also agree with the Emerald in terms of the provision review in terms of the legal supply and the ability. I think the approach in terms of the duplication, especially with the stuff, I agree with this. I was pretty much concerned if the emphasis would have been on the low wage employees. But I think it happened there. But I think it's actually, if you take further, you find that almost across the department, even mm-hmm. in the public sector, sometimes they don't blow that at that level. So I agree with that. But this one, I think it has responded, but one cannot avoid to raise it, because if you look at the disaster that you mentioned in terms of the budget for policy and the growth, I see that it's attributing it to the number of economic depression that we've seen in policy. But my interest is also to check, because from that period, I think the period where we have introduced a number of policies like you mentioned, the iPad stuff. So if you can check also the impact analysis of those policies, because one needs to check, despite the fact that we might have had economic depression and stuff, but we have introduced policies and we have allocated huge amounts of assets, what is the role of those policies? Well, I know that also, from that point, if you look at that economic growth decline, it was a time where also foreign labor dealing the sectors, which I think in my view were contributing to economic growth strongly at the time. So if you look at the period where the economic growth declined, it is not just characterized by economic depression, it is also characterized by policy positions that were taken, including the dealing of sectors with the Department of Labor. So if I can just have a comment there. Yes.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Honorable Members. Honorable Hollis, the issue of the choice of the unemployment rate, I think what is important for us is more about the trend. How does unemployment, because I don't think that if you use the expanded definition, you will have a different picture. So the magnitude is not important there. So the gap will only be bigger. That's what will happen. If you use the expanded definition, because what it does is like it will shift your trend line upwards. So it makes no difference. The trend is what is more critical. How does economic growth link with unemployment, in whatever definition? I think the issue of the choice between the narrow and the expanded definition, you will be answering a different type of a policy question. Are your, for example, programs that you are directing at employment creation making sense? You are measuring those. So you can say, this is the dent that we have made on unemployment because of program A, program B, program C. But here, we are saying the economy in aggregate is moving in this direction. So even the growth figures, the growth numbers that I have, there's somebody can say to me, no, but why are you using GDP instead of GNP, for example? Because the number will change. But the trend is what is more important. So the most accessible, uncontested the number is this one that says that supply. So we could have gone the expanded unemployment figure. We will still have somebody saying, no, but this one does not include this. So you must also do, or no, you must exclude the informal sector, such a whole range of things. So we try to work with trends rather than. So I do accept you, but all I'm saying is that what you will have is really a shift of that pattern on the side, which is my left-hand side, that actually measures the unemployment rate. Now, let me say, your question around the Auditor General's finding around the regular expenditure and the accounting office, that's a standard matter that the Auditor General will raise when there is irregular expenditure. Now, the point is that irregular expenditure is not necessarily something that you will say this has got a negative effect on the economy. It's just that it did not comply with certain provisions, for example, procurement, it did not comply with certain sections of that. Now, ultimately, it's either condoned because there was value generated, there was nobody that was unduly enriched or whatever. It will then be condoned. The question that you might want to ask is now, because the Auditor General raised this issue around irregular expenditure, what is now the status with this? Because it's a finding that there is in the annual report. Until it's either condoned or somebody has to close that gap, if somebody benefited, somebody must be held accountable for that. So the question is like, what has been done around it? Was it condoned? If it was condoned, why was it condoned? So that the question that comes to engage the department. Let me answer also the comment from Honorable Paul. It's one of those kinds of vexing issues. Now, if we shift the teachers from where they were, and we shift them to where they are now, which is higher education and training, does it make a difference for South African economy? One, does it make a difference for the Department of Labor? The Department of Labor is probably one less headache to deal with. We are all aware that teachers were probably the biggest underspenders of resources that they have. Quite a number of them, interventions had to be put in place to put them under administration as soon as they were taken over by the Department of Higher Education. So there's a number of them where there were significant challenges. If you look at their audit reports, a significant number. So we can't paint all of them with that brush, but certainly quite a significant number. Yes, serious challenges. And resources, even up to today, there are resources that are there that are not actually being spent. So, the impact of that kind of a decision, would have, because they were not closed down, they're still there. So for the economy, whatever they were doing, sitting under the Department of Labor, their mandate was not changed. The mandate was not changed, except to reinforce and say, can we also look at some of these other issues as teachers, because it's about capacitating the workforce. That's what it's about, and scaling more people. So ultimately, I wouldn't say that the teachers, they are shifting from one department to the other. But that's my comment. We can try and see what's the impact the Department of Labor, because there are some programs that we basically link to what the department is doing that we've done within the ambit of the teachers. So that one can actually have a look at that in looking at whether the impact of the department in terms of its own mandate was affected by virtue of transferring the teachers to the other department. So that's a separate type of a question that we can look at. Can you respond to the other question?
There was one question, and there is one question. I just want to follow up on which I didn't cover in the previous response. There was a question about whether the visa indicated that Nisha's visa crisis is for 2015-16. Yes, as for the second quarter of 2015-16, we didn't look at quarter three, but we just picked up for quarter two, and yes, once the department. The response, obviously, once this particular quarter comes to an end, we will then be able to see, in terms of the overall performance, that particularly indicate how the department actually performed for the sector. I just want to go back to Honorable Mulili. She asked a question about, I don't know if I got the name right, but she asked a question about how is it that we say that there is no spending information, but we are able to get this data here. And this data looks at the spending, any spending things for the department as a whole. And this information is published by the National Treasury. but they don't place this down into sending private departments to the clients. That information is usually contained within the quarterly performance reports. There's a specific section in the quarterly performance reports where the department is expected to report on that information. For most of the programs and for most of the indicators, that information is missing. If we couldn't do an assessment at a program level to look at whether the performance of the program is more or less aligned with the spending performance. Yeah, thank you.
Can I ask two questions? One, on this follow-up question, one follow-up question on what was raised by Honorable Mandashe in relation to the fund that would be taken from the community. I listened carefully to your answer. I want to understand that you referred to the unused of funds at time being the reason at time being the incapacity because if you don't know how to do your job properly or how to use this, you may end up not spending. Now, at what stage do you decide, you said you hate with children, that's what I said, when they do that, because it's not like taken. The fact remains is that it is used. You are not in a position to use it because it has been shifted to another department. It's not like it's there. At what stage do you do that? Because I think that yourself and treasury, when you allocate money to this department or the progress of this department, you do check the question of capacity, whether the money that they are looking for will be used accordingly. And on top of that, you also do the monitoring for the activities. You can even do it monthly basis. So you can do that. Have people in all the departments that are doing monitoring the money that they are allocating. At what stage then do you reach when do you get to the stage of taking the money? What has happened to your monitoring? Because your monitoring should have told you the red light that this money is not used. The second year or 6 months, they have their targets, annual targets. So as you check, you see the red light, this money is not being used. Like you see in the Department of Labor that the first 2-3 quarters, they are fine with the indicators. It's only the fourth quarter then that you don't know, because all along you can see the indicators are saying they are going to get to the target. Is it the same or has it been the same with the Eastern Cape? Well, I think the question of the Eastern Cape and education is coming along a long way. So why have you not been able to deal with the red lights instead of decide? I know you have to do that, but why don't you avoid it? And then the second question, the growth and unemployment. Is there a link between growth and non-investment of some companies in South Africa? I understand the question of the crisis, but I want to understand, is there any link I listened to you when you talk about these scenarios. I've forgotten about the scenarios. South Africa adopted business as usual at some stage because there was growth and did not foresee that it's going to turn ugly. Because were they relying on the investment, thinking that the growth that is taking place in the country will also be plowed back equally to the growth? How is it? I think it's a failing.
Your second question is a very complicated one, but I'll try and answer it. The first question around the stopping or taking away of an allocation. First of all, it is a division, it's a provision in the Division of Revenue Act. Now, if you put it in law and there is a grant framework for that specific grant, there is a person who is responsible for the grant in a national department that they refer to as the transferring officer. Now, when money is actually stopped for a province and reallocated to somebody else, it's the culmination of a process, because these numbers must be submitted on a monthly basis to allow somebody at the Treasury to focus and check whether at the rate at which this money is being spent, are we going to be able to spend it all by the end of the year as we assumed. Now, if the department has produced its projections and they say, invariably, in most cases, we will get projections that say we will overspend. But if you look back a year, 2 years, you will find that you have been giving the same story. That's not look, you're not going to be able to spend this amount of money. But you keep on giving the warning. So there are letters that are exchanged. The National Treasury cannot come in and say there's no capacity, let's build capacity, without the department having said so, or requested assistance to that effect. The National Treasury can assist, because most of these grants deal with big infrastructure projects, especially in education. There's a planning framework there. There are incentives that are in place to be able to allow somebody to incentivize all these issues around planning, proper planning, and capacitating the required or requisite capacity, making accurate and proper projections in terms of how we are going to manage this project. So the onus and the responsibility should primarily rest with the line function department, not with the treasurer. The treasurer's interest is that when we allocate money in a constrained fiscal environment, the money is actually going to be spent. Because every money that is allocated and is not spent, it's not good to come back and say we saved this much money when you have not delivered the services. People are running around all over the place. They have not received the services that and the money was allocated. Now, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, if you persistently do that as an accounting officer, there is certain steps, measures that must be taken against you, because you are persistently contravening the spirit of this piece of legislation. Now, in rare circumstances, would you find that an accounting officer responsible for this type of a program has actually lost his job because this thing is failing. So we don't have those kinds of well, we don't apply, even though they are there in the law, that you can say, if this consistent breach is happening on an annual basis, what must we do? Because you can say, let's capacitate. So you send people there to go and work with this person, and then when when you leave, the problem starts again. Because now what you're saying, if you look at the Eastern Cape issue with education, it comes a very long way. And we all know what the challenges have been. And the results in education in the Eastern Cape speak for themselves. There have been those challenges. They have been implementing agents for the Eastern Cape education infrastructure program. They've been implementing agents who have moved from ICT to Bulatra, Buha, but now you've got the TBSA. So it's been a mission around these types of issues. But the real issue is that this type of an intervention is not something that's taken very lightly. It is something that is a culmination of warnings, red lights, because your IOMs basically are meant to do that. They are meant, and the Treasury is very vigilant when it comes to those types of issues. And they do write letters to say, at this rate, this is not going to happen. Can you justify why we should not actually intervene in this particular manner? But no, the department, the Land Functions Department, has to respond to that. Now, sometimes there are different views because you are getting into the executive authority of a province pitted against the executive authority of a national department. It might not meet in terms of the objectives and how you want to deal with the problem. There might have to be conversations that actually take place that drag before final decisions are made. And once the process is taking place, the understanding is continuing, so there's a stop. And so what you don't want to do is to say we allocated this money for education infrastructure. We only managed to do this, but we still have this much money. So if a program is, similar program is happening and it's working in Limpopo, there is nothing wrong with taking that money, giving it to Limpopo for this year and say to Eastern Cape, please sort your house, next year you get the money. Because it's never taken away the money. It still remains your money. It's just that this year is going to be used where it is going to be absorbed. That's the theory of that. So the obviously what you are raising, Honorable Chair, is how do you ensure that that capacity that is resulting in this understanding is actually built and retained in the province. Because sometimes what the National Department tends to do is they come in, they take over, they do what is supposed to be done, they leave, and then once they leave, things go back the way they were. Because there has not been that transfer of skills. I think it might be important to also take like a cue from the what happens in the Limpopo with the Section 100. There's some departments that were assisted that basically now went back to normal departments. There are some that, so it depends. Now the second question, what you are asking me, if I can rephrase it, you're asking me what the relationship between investment and growth in South Africa is. Am I getting you right? Or the way you put it, you say it's non-investment. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But my question is,
you know, we do know that there are companies who are not investing in South Africa.
Okay.
That's what I'm asking. So, and you would think that when they are growing, the money will be reinvested in South Africa. Is that not contributing to an environment? Should we only look at the global crisis and other issues that you have explained? What about those who benefit from South Africa, the resources from South Africa, and then be other countries benefit out of it?
No, I think I don't understand the conflict. There is obviously a negative impact of that kind of behavior by South Africans on the economic growth and therefore unemployment in South Africa. Now, you see, if you take a very standard definition of what contributes to economic growth, it's investment, translate it for service, that investment. So if you take your domestic service, you can translate your domestic service into investment. So now if I have my savings and then I decide that I'm going to take my savings outside of South Africa, I'm already subtracting from investment in South Africa, because it's part and parcel of that. Government expenditure is part and parcel of that. So government expenditure, if we reduce government expenditure, which is non-investment, we reduce it, we reduce aggregate demand, we basically reduce investment, and therefore we have an impact on economic growth. So in a way, the question that one must ask about these people that have the money but are not investing in South Africa, are choosing elsewhere. The question is, what is it that we're not doing right in South Africa? That's number one. Number two, what is it that those countries in which they are investing, what is it that those countries have that we don't have in South Africa? Now, you have all of these measures that economists use, business confidence, are they confident in the future? So they put this competitiveness indices that they use. They talk about political stability, they talk about, I say that some economists talk about labor legislation and all of that. All of those things get into that. But what you are asking, whether non-investment is not an issue when it comes to unemployment, the answer is a definite, it is an issue. It is a contributor. And that is why it's also important in the context of the global efforts to try and deal with some of this type of money that basically just leaves the country and never comes back. Nobody has to pay anything for it. They call them illicit flows of money that just gets taken away from these countries. And I think the former President Thabo Mbeki is doing some work around that. What it costs Africa, I think the figure that I saw today is over $1 trillion. That is out there. That if you look at what the African continent requires in order to address some of the developmental challenges, which include addressing the problem of unemployment, $1 trillion can go a very long way. That is out there.
Thank you very much for that answer, because you know, when we talk about unemployment as the South Africans, the only arrow for the reason of the rocketing or skyrocketing numbers of unemployment is looking at one way. We are not doing this. Deliberately not analyzing that side, because the statistics is out there of the companies that are in South Africa benefiting from South Africa that are for South Africans who take their money and send it somewhere else. So I think those are other things that as we talk about unemployment, we should also analyze them and bring them to the fore. I think that we have exhausted the discussion, and we thank you very much, Chairperson, for your contribution, because we are learning it is important to us that when we are to meet a department, at least we sharpen our knowledge a bit, so that we, by the time we come in front of us, we are more knowledgeable. Knowledge is continuous and has no ending. So thank you so much. We'll keep on knocking at your door so that we get more information. And those who are, thank you, we will excuse you. Members, need your guidance, because in the program we have only Well, okay, I think we can do that one. It's only one set of units. And then after that. Okay. Maybe for now we can just put the set of minutes that is in front of us. The minutes were sent to you in advance. Any changes?
That's okay.
That's it. So you are calling for an adoption. Honorable Bankrain is proposing adoption of the minutes of the last day, and Honorable Jobo is seconding the minutes have been adopted.
That when we come back, it will be that rush of it is
So when these items that Honorable Olive is proposing are not being prioritized, he needs to understand that it may be because we are forced by parliamentary program to focus first on the EPCs when we come back. So I'm proposing that Zolani, now that having listened to the focus item, he looks at the spaces that are there, and then next week we deal with the draft program.
Thank you, Honorable Oliver. We have adopted the draft program last week, and we said with the draft program, and we said we are adopting it knowing that it might be changed. It is the ominous. The draft program, yes, was adopted. Once you adopt a draft, yes, it's not, it's different. So the draft program that is outstanding is the draft program that we will include when we come back. But this one, it has me. So I think that proposal from Honorable Lawyer that next week, next week is the last week, next week Wednesday when we meet, we have to have time to include or to redo the draft with the items that we have not been able to do and the new items. And it has to be circulated before Wednesday so that we are able to look at it.
That's fine, I agree to that. My only comment is, you see, if you did, I must have stepped up with my phone when you were approving that. I apologize for that, but that happens. But my comment is, you see, we still approved the program for this term 1 week before the end of the term.
Mm-hmm.
We should approve it at the beginning so we know what's coming. Thanks.
I think we must look to our minutes members. This draft has been changing faces because we are depending on what the health chair is bringing. I think what we should do now, so that it stays to members, anytime, whenever Zolani will bring this report and take decisions on it, you must have a separate record here on your PC so that when you come in, even if you don't have minutes, you then say, on a certain date, we spoke about a draft program and we have agreed as a committee to continue. Because it has been changing, and unfortunately we are not able to follow it as we want to follow it, because when that program of parliament changes, everything changes, which we have no control over it. But we'll do it. Yes, I think it must be with you by the end of the day, Monday. That was the last item. And thank you for cooperating, tolerating, understanding, and that good work produced this agenda.
Thank you.
from now.